So, Allison, your book was published on September 24th, and that was, I would think, almost to the very day the breaking news about the whistleblower came out. And it's been in the news and growing every single day. How did that feel to have this book on whistleblowing come out at this very time?
It's kind of an indescribable feeling because it almost seems surreal. But in part, my book was really anticipating this very moment. So that part about it felt gratifying because I felt like I had written something that could explain the moment we were in and help people to understand what was at stake. So that part was great, but couldn't have anticipated it in a million years, obviously.
Yeah, some people I'm probably saying, and I'm sure, I don't know if the whistleblower blew your mind, at least the news
yeah.
about it.
The whistleblower did blow my mind, yes.
Yeah.
For all kinds of reasons.
But what's more perfect to come out with a book and have this happen, which provides a lot of illustration for the things that you write about. When did you decide? You've done a lot of things. You've been involved with foreign policy. You've testified or you've been a speaker or offered information, whatever the right word is, at a number of committees, including congressional committees. What, and I know you have your PhD in political science. What interests you, and when was it that you decided you wanted to actually write a book on whistleblowing?
Well, this is really interesting because my background really combines to, I think, give me a unique perspective on current events. I wrote a previous book called One Nation Under Contract, and that was a book about the privatization of American national security, how we were increasingly using contractors instead of government employees in all sorts of areas of foreign policy. And what I realized from writing that book was when you outsource something to the private sector, it kind of becomes shrouded in secrecy. And the line between business and government is increasingly blurry. So you also get the revolving door between government and the private sector that's at issue in some of the news today. And I looked at that and I thought, you know, this is really something to think about. We are really trusting our elites behind closed doors to make decisions that are in our interest, in the interest of the American people, instead of their own self-interest. And I thought that's really a huge degree of trust. How do we keep our elites honest? And that took me to the topic of whistleblowers, because whistleblowers are one way we keep our elites honest. So it came together nicely. I've also done some consulting work for the State Department and for whistleblowers. I interviewed all the NSA whistleblowers, including Edward Snowden, plus the senior leadership of the NSA at the time of the Snowden leaks. So that gives me a pretty good idea of what normal behavior is in Washington and allows me to identify what is not normal, which is the times we currently inhabit.
Right. I haven't quite finished reading your entire book, but I know that there is, in what I have read, I have really learned a great deal. And one of the lines that gets me, I don't know if it's a line in the book or if it was from, your book is published by Yale University Press, and in one of the press releases it says that you talk about in this book, which you surely do from what I've read so far, the centrality of whistleblowing to the health of American democracy. And for some reason, that phrase, the health of American democracy, as we look at and wonder and in many cases get depressed about what's happening to the state of our democracy, it's really, really true. And it's fascinating, the history you wrote. I would love for you to talk about, I had no idea at all how far back whistleblowing goes, even though the word at that time was not, that term was not in existence. So you want to share with listeners the very first example of whistleblowing back in
78. Yeah. No, once you start looking into this, it's absolutely fascinating. You realize how integral it is to the American experience and our sense of dissent and freedom of the press, freedom of speech. There's a big connection between whistleblowing and the First Amendment. And there's a reason the First Amendment is first in the eyes of the founders. But it goes back all the way in time, as you mentioned, to 1778. when a group of 10 sailors blew the whistle on the first commander-in-chief of the United States Navy, a man by the name of Essex Hopkins. Hopkins had been enraging them for all sorts of reasons, one primary one being he tortured British prisoners of war. And that was kind of part of historical knowledge before I wrote my book. But what I found in researching my book and digging further in the archives is there was a deeper story to Essex Hopkins, that the real reason Congress removed him from his post and legislated whistleblower protection is that he was using his public office for private gain. General Washington would tell him to engage the British in Chesapeake Bay. He would instead take his ships, the U.S. Navy, and sail them to the Bahamas instead to perform a mission that advanced his financial interests. So it's a very clear case of a public official using his office for private gain, making money during wartime, which is a really damaging thing. So Congress didn't put up with this. They legislated the first whistleblower protection law. They got two of the 10 sailors, two were Rhode Islanders, and Essex Hopkins was from Rhode Island. So that meant they got thrown in jail. The other eight didn't go in jail. But Congress got them out of jail, paid their legal fees, and even passed legislation that said all the records related to this misconduct have to be made available to the public, which is why we have the information, why I can tell you the story today. So it is really clear that from the very start, Americans thought they were going to do democracy different. They thought Britain was corrupt. That's part of the reason the revolution was necessary. And they were going to do democracy the honest way. And it's been in place ever since in American history. So I trace that right through to the Trump administration in the book.
Yeah, flash forward 300 plus years. It seems like, has anything changed?
Yeah, no, it's always, this is human nature. People do different things when no one's looking than they'll do in full view. Although that may be changing with this president, because he does things that usually the standard pattern with whistleblowers is you reveal the misconduct and the people are ashamed, they resign, or the public is outraged and insists that something be done. But what's interesting about this current situation is things are spinning so rapidly and the president is actually admitting, oh yeah, I did these things that are really unprecedented. So it's an interesting time.
So why don't you give a quote-unquote official definition of what is of whistleblowing?
Well, whistleblowers really reveal misconduct. I focus in my book on government. So in that case, it's usually either illegal or unconstitutional activity that they bring to light. But there's whistleblowing, obviously, in the corporate sector, and that involves waste, fraud, and abuse, health and safety issues. It's a very broad topic. And originally, I started looking at all of whistleblowing in the book, and that led to hundreds and hundreds of pages that had to be cut because I wanted whistleblowers to really move and tell an important story and stay focused on the government realm. But it's a concept that exists in the private sector as well and is very important for keeping the powerful honest and making sure that you can right a bad situation before it gets worse.
I'm going to want you to give some examples of whistleblowers. Of course, they're the really well-known ones that are still in the news, like Snowden. And I think a lot of people know the history, even if they were really, really young at the point when Nixon was president and then the Pentagon Papers, et cetera. You call whistleblowers truth tellers.
Mm-hmm.
And can I assume the subtitle in your book, Honesty in It's Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. So when you're talking about honesty, you're talking about the whistleblowers?
Yes, they speak truth to power. They reveal, you know, the facts of the matter. And what I came to realize in researching the book was how important that distinction between truth and false and believing it existed, that there were some things that are factually true and some things that are not, that is so important for the functioning of democracy. Because in a democracy, you know, the truth emerges from public deliberation. It's not what the supreme leader says it is. So that's why honesty is so important in whistleblowing, and why you see time and time again that whistleblowers are really keeping people honest and exposing lies. So Ellsberg with the Pentagon paper, what is the crux of that whistleblowing? He's showing that the United States government is lying to the American people repeatedly about how the Vietnam War is going. They're saying we're making great advances, and they're actually, it's getting worse and worse. So Ellsberg really forced them to acknowledge what the truth was about the war. And obviously, the people running the war didn't like it.
You know, so we're talking about, in your mind, whistleblowers being truth tellers and speaking with honesty and reporting information that's really important for folks to know, whether it's in their business or whether it's in the public sector. What about whistleblowers, or is this a contradiction in terms? Have there been whistleblowers who turn out to be folks who have been lying? Do they then not become a whistleblower?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question, because it takes us to the heart of the current matter, which is that, and I've written this in a couple of opinion pieces for the Washington Post and New York Times, that what matters about whistleblowing in a democracy in the United States is the content of the complaint. In other words, what the facts are. Somebody suggesting, I have a reasonable belief that I have seen something that's improper, illegal, unconstitutional, and so I'm turning over that information to you to judge whether it's so. And so that the efficacy of the complaint really rides on whether those facts bear out. So we, in a sense, whistleblowers need to let the facts speak for themselves. There's a lot of partisan spin and noise that tells us, you know, we have to look at their motives, we have to look at whether they're lying. Well, whether they're lying is going to come out if you look at the facts, right? But in my book, I show how the motives really aren't that important, because people have all sorts of mixed motives. You know, motives are often a matter of opinion. I mean, think about people you know. You try to evaluate their motives. One day you think they're one thing, another day it might be another. But that doesn't really matter for whistleblowing. In Watergate, for example, Deep Throat, who revealed the abuse of power on the part of President Nixon, his name was Mark Felt. And he had all kinds of mixed motives. He was the number two at the FBI, and he wanted to be number one. So by releasing this information, he was undercutting his rival. But at the same time, this information revealed things that the American people needed to know about, and they led to the removal of the president from office. So that's why I say we need to focus on the content of the complaint, and the motives don't really matter. But you're going to get a lot of partisan spin and noise telling you to look at it from all other sorts of angles.
Right. And now we have whistleblower being called a traitor.
Well, that's understandable in the national security community, because national security whistleblowing is the most fraught, because anybody who's involved in intelligence or national security is supposed to keep classified information secret. So simply by bringing that information out into the open, they're breaking a law, arguably in support of a higher principle, but it's a very fraught space.
Well, when that statement was made by Trump, that I think he was referring to the whistleblower, that he was a traitor, and you know what we used to do with traitors, and that was really obvious to most people what he was referring to. Like we shot them or hung them or whatever it was, and you know, people are being very respectful, by and large, of, well, we don't yet know the identity of the whistleblower, and we really shouldn't know the identity of the whistleblower. And the fact remains that there have been a series of laws from the very, very beginning that seem to change, and sometimes there's more protection. Do you think that there's enough protection theoretically to right now in this time and place to encourage people to whistleblow?
No, there isn't. And if anything, it's very discouraging to future whistleblowers when the president of the United States is inciting his supporters to retaliate against a whistleblower by a tweet that his own intelligence community inspector general has deemed a legitimate complaint that should be put forward to Congress. It's important to realize that Michael Atkinson, that's the intelligence community inspector general who listened to the whistleblower complaint, corroborated some of the things he or she said, and then wanted to turn it over to Congress. That man is a Trump appointee. So it's significant that this person chose to put it forward. In my view, that it even came forward is a miracle, because national security whistleblowing is so hard to do for reasons you mentioned about the law. We have a great law called the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act of 2012, and that law protects whistleblowers from retaliation, but it explicitly excludes members of the national security community. And so there's some other laws that in a sense, try to create that channel through which this complaint rose. But if that statute says national security whistleblowers are excluded, and the intelligence community is about keeping secrets, you can imagine what it's like to be an intelligence community employee and think, I've seen something that I think is wrong. I think it's a national security threat. I need to report it. But you realize that it's going to be seen as behavior that, you know, may not even be listened to. So, and when we see what happens to people who blow the whistle in the intelligence community afterwards, in that they usually lose everything, they're a very powerful disincentive not to come forward. So I think it's a miracle that this complaint has come forward and is before Congress, and the American people should make it very clear they want that whistleblower's identity protected. The intelligence community is nonpartisan. They think their job is to provide the unvarnished truth to policymakers so that Americans can make the best foreign policy for the United States. They also don't want to release information because and it's true. One little seemingly innocuous bit of information can be that missing jigsaw puzzle piece for one of our enemies. So they don't talk about what they do. They're not at all inclined to be whistleblowers. And this is very unusual behavior that we're seeing. But it's not partisan behavior. It's not a deep state conspiracy. What they're doing is patriotic. They swore an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, like the president. And what they're seeing puts democracy at risk, and certainly puts our foreign policy at risk. So it's not a partisan issue. It really is an American issue.
Yeah, you believe that Edward Snowden, who is certainly a controversial individual, that he may eventually be viewed as our first traitor patriot.
Yes, I say that he may one day be, because you have to look at what Snowden did, and it's very controversial, and I'm aware of that. But he really revealed a national security agency that put in place emergency measures after 9/11, which were understandable. We had been attacked on our own soil, the Pentagon, the World Trade Center. But what happened is years passed, and those emergency operating procedures became business as usual. But we never had a public conversation about it, and indeed, nobody really realized that was the case. So in that sense, Snowden, I think, performed a public service by forcing that conversation. And we had that conversation as a result, and Congress changed the Patriot Act in response. So it's this interesting case of someone breaking the law, fleeing the country, doing things that look enormously suspicious, but ostensibly with a higher purpose of making sure our democracy stayed alive and we didn't become sort of some sort of surveillance state, that, you know, individual rights were protected as prescribed by our Constitution and Bill of Rights.
In case you just joined us, this is Women's Focus. My name is Carol Boss, and my guest this afternoon is Dr. Alison Stanger. She is the author of the brand new book, and how relevant it is right now. And the book is Whistleblowers, Honesty in America, From Washington to Trump, and it's published by Yale Press. Do you have examples of, if we go to communities, where, for example, a community, and I'm not thinking of anything particular where there might have been a whistleblower. I'm certainly thinking of Michigan, where they're having all the issues about the water. And Are there instances where there are whistleblowers who are reporting things like that?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And I mean, ideally what you want is, and that's why whistleblower protection is so important, because the ideal resolution to these problems is, if you're a company or a government agency and someone comes to you and says, I've seen this going on, it's wrong, you're going to say, you're right, that's a violation of our rules. Let's let's fix that. And you could do it without any external knowledge of it. And then you'd prevent a big public relations disaster. The problem is that people, whistleblowers oftentimes are saying, they're looking at the status quo and saying, actually, that's not okay. And everybody around them is saying, what do you mean? This is just what we do. And so you don't get that response from within. But I think organizations and government alike have a vested interest in ensuring that they have those procedures in place, because the consequence otherwise is that the ship goes off the rails. I mean, you don't have like a meltdown like Enron or WorldCom if whistleblowers had been listened to inside the company. And the same is true for, our government today. Without this whistleblower, we would not know about this curious pursuit of private interest at the expense of our stated foreign policy, because that's what's at stake in the complaint. You have the alleged cover-up, but you also have the president with his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and these two business associates who were arrested leaving the country yesterday. They're involved in a shadow foreign policy with Ukraine. And it's all about the president's reelection, and it's all about getting people, foreigners, to help with both money and with influence. And that's completely at odds with the anti-corruption foreign policy of the United States as administered by the U.S. State Department and for which Congress appropriated money. So that's why the military aid with Ukraine is significant, is because that really was money Congress approved. And yet the president is pursuing a foreign policy at direct odds with the stated foreign policy. And it's clear it's not because he's doing it for the country. He's doing it for his own private interests. And so that is something that's very dangerous, it's particularly in the unstable world we're in today, where other countries are looking at us and not knowing what to expect. And some places like Iran may be poised to try to exploit the president's weakness and lack of having a very strong team behind him. Usually the president lines up all the agencies and, there are internal disputes, but you don't have this scenario where people are serving in positions as acting secretaries, and you have kind of a revolving door in a number of the positions. So that's a very unstable and dangerous situation from a national security point of view when events are moving quickly and things happen to which the president has to respond. Not to worry you, not to worry your listeners about, a world that already makes us anxious. But
right.
I think we're really seeing conduct that needs to be investigated.
I think there is, I don't even know how they're going to tackle all the things that need to be investigated. Let's steer back a little bit to the concept of democracy and why. So the founders of going back to the 1700s, they viewed whistleblowing, in a sense, as a valuable action against tyranny. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting to kind of just even read the statute itself, the language, and I have that in my book, because it really drives home how important they saw whistleblowing to be. And I won't go ahead and read you the, it's this old English, but what it essentially says is you have a duty, if you see wrongdoing, to report it. That's your obligation as a citizen.
Right.
Not only just as a government employee. And I think that there's this very real idea that's important, that if we're going to have a government that serves the people, we the people, we can't have our top officials looking out for themselves and not for all of us. And so that's what whistleblowing is all about. It's all about keeping government focused on what it should be doing for we the people, which shouldn't be improving your own personal brand or, stocking away billions in an offshore bank somewhere. that the founders would have cringed at. They put the emoluments clause in the Constitution for a reason. They didn't want the president doing that.
Probably it's a point where maybe people should carry around their pocket constitutions. And we the people, this is me speaking, in my opinion, in a lot of cases, really need to wake up.
Yeah, the system itself is at stake, and I carry around a pocket constitution because it is inspiring to go back and read it. And when you read it, you realize that, there's a separation of powers. Congress has certain rights. The president has certain rights. You realize there's a clause, the emoluments clause, that forbids the president using his office for private gain. There's the 25th Amendment. It's a really rich document that actually says, you know, if the president is unable to fulfill his duties, they can be removed from office, and describes the order of succession. So there are a lot of mechanisms we have for changing our leaders when things appear to be dangerous. But that's, I can't stress this enough. It sounds partisan, but it isn't partisan. It's really an American issue, and this is something in which Democrats and Republicans alike, I think, can agree on, that, you know, we want a system, we want the Constitution and the rule of law to be upheld, because the rule of law is so important for business. I mean, if you want to have small business entrepreneurship, you need the rule of law. The alternative is crony capitalism, where the oligarchs get to decide what is and is not permitted. And you can imagine what happens to small businesses and entrepreneurship, all these things that make the United States such a vibrant nation economically under those set of circumstances. So this should really be an issue that unites people across partisan lines.
I wrote down this one line that you have early in the book. It might have even been the introduction. You write about the concept of committing truth, and we talked about that, and say whistleblowing serves the interest of truth, and all whistleblowers, true whistleblowers, that's me, commit truth.
Yeah.
And what then you wrote that because they highlight, this really hit me, because they highlight the gap between American ideals and lived reality, they unveil behavior that the rich and powerful would like to keep secret.
Yes, they do. That's an Ernie Fitzgerald term, committing truth. And he's this brave soul who exposed all kind of waste, fraud, and abuse at the Pentagon with big defense contracts. And he's someone that, if you listen to the secret tapes of Richard Nixon, you know, he's asking that the man be fired, and he's using expletives to describe him. But committing truth is central to whistleblowing, and it extends to other regions as well. I mean, I'm thinking about this in the future for maybe something to write about that. I think, you know, in some sense, the hashtag MeToo movement originated in a whistleblower, because you had somebody saying, wait a minute, this happened to me, and it's not right. And they were elites. They were, you know, privileged people. But then you saw this interesting response where it kind of rippled through society. You had all these people saying, wait, that's happened to me too. And I think you can see that in any walk, any area where privilege is at play and ordinary people are being exploited at the expense of the powerful. But whistleblowers really kind of, in a sense, make us remove our blind spots. So sometimes it could take a little bit of time for people to realize that what they're doing is wrong, but we have to give them the opportunity to learn and grow and hopefully make for a better country.
You know, it is interesting that you brought up the Me Too movement. And the unfortunate thing is, because I think there have been people who have talked about what has gone on in at maybe a work situation or whatever, where there's sexual misconduct, and they wind up actually getting into trouble for it, and in some cases need to leave their job because it's so highly uncomfortable. And that actually, in some respects, discourages a lot of women from reporting or being whistleblowers about this.
That's right. That's right. And that's why people put up with things that they probably shouldn't be putting up with. And again, it's a matter of the places where these things are happening have rules against harassment. But it's just a case of the laws not being upheld. They're being violated. You have the right laws. See, it's not enough to just have the right laws. You've also got to insist that they be enforced equally and are actually obeyed. And so that's what's often at stake in a lot of whistleblower moments, is an insistence that the law needs to be upheld. And the pattern you see actually is after a whistleblower kind of speaks truth to power and brings the facts out into the public eye, say, take with Watergate. You know, the president is removed from, he resigns his office, and then Congress can respond with laws that try to prevent that from happening again. So I think that's really interesting, that the whole inspector general system, that is the mechanism through which this complaint rose, that's rocking the nation, That's put in place in 1978, and it's a measure that's taken because we just saw what happened with Richard Nixon and Watergate. We don't want it to happen again. So here's a way to try to prevent that. And we could do that after this crisis has passed as well and legislate to make it more clear what the president can and cannot do. We could have anti-corrupt practices legislation. We can fix national security whistleblowing. There's a whole number of things we could do. So one message in my book is that when you take the long view, the current moment doesn't seem as anxiety-provoking because we've been in a gilded age before, and we managed to get back on track. And it happens time and time again, and I see no reason why we can't do it again.
You know, you just mentioned, I'm glad you did that, because you mentioned the year 1978, so that's exactly 300 years after the first whistleblowing.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, 200 years.
Oh,
but you're right.
Yeah, 200.
It's the anniversary
year. Yeah, 200 years.
It's the bicentennial.
Right.
It was the bicentennial. Yeah.
I'm going to read something from your book. And
okay.
You write that whistleblowers also uphold individual rights that would otherwise be trampled by majority preferences. Rights always matter most to those who must struggle for them. Slavery and the subjection of women, for example, were once both legal and popular, despite being built on the lie that blacks and women were not full humans worthy of rights and legal equality. Enfranchised white males were able to turn a blind eye to gross injustice because they did not suffer its consequences. And it is always the privilege who decide whether rights have been violated.
Yeah,
I'm so glad you wrote that.
Yeah, well, there's a power dynamic involved in all this, right? Because whistleblowers are calling out the powerful, and the powerful have resources to retaliate. So it's a dangerous proposition. And if you look at what happens to most whistleblowers, I call this the paradox of whistleblowing in America. We celebrate whistleblowers in practice. That's why you see both Democrats and Republicans unanimously support turning the whistleblower complaint over to Congress. But what happens over time when public attention wanders, the media looks elsewhere, whistleblowers commonly lose everything. They lose their jobs. They lose their friends and family are retaliated against. They have to sacrifice the career they're in. And it's not for the faint of heart. And we should be grateful for our whistleblowers for keeping democracy vibrant and keeping us all thinking for ourselves.
Yeah, I'm going to read one more part. And you actually end this little part with, this is what the book seeks to deliver. And you wrote before that, whistleblowing is thus an important part of what makes American democracy distinctive. The pursuit of a more perfect union is impossible unless we are free to identify instances where we have fallen short. American constitutional democracy depends on a common understanding of the proper place of whistleblowing in America. And this is what this book seeks to deliver.
Mm-hmm. It definitely is. And it's really a question of just, you have American ideals and you have the reality. And, you know, oftentimes, more often than not, the ideals aren't realized, but that's what we work on together as a nation to try to close that gap. And for all the problems we currently face, as a professor of political science, and I have tenure, so no one can fire me for what I say. So I have no interest in spinning things. My interest is in telling the truth. And what I see when I look out at other countries and when I see the progress we made over time in this country, the United States is really a distinctive and unique and fragile experiment. We can't take for granted that it will continue, and it's up to all of us to keep democracy alive.
So as far as for you, Allison, the book coming out just when all this was happening, someone writes a book and they usually go, depending, they go touring and they go to bookstores and they sign books and read from the book and they talk a little bit. This has gone a little further with you. I know you were on NPR. I didn't get to hear the story, but I realized yesterday there was an NPR interview with you, and you've probably been interviewed quite a bit. Is this a whole new interesting venture for you, given the timing of all of this?
Yeah, well, it feels really, again, gratifying to be able to help people, you know, have the context to understand what's going on. And so I've felt an obligation to speak out as much as possible to journalists, but also on the radio and on television, just because I'm concerned about my country and I'd like to see us get back on track as soon as possible. So yes, it's exhausting, but it's also exhilarating. And I just am desperate to get people to realize that this isn't partisan. This is patriotic, what's happening right now. It's about the system itself. So regardless of whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, you should care about your country and you should care about constitutional democracy. So that's what's at stake.
Even though what you just said is probably the perfect way to end, what I do want to ask you is, do you think there's anything that us citizens, we the people, can do to support and make in some fashion the life of whistleblowers easier and safer?
Absolutely. You can just insist that this whistleblower be protected. You can insist that whistleblower complaints be heard. And if the American people have that attitude, the politicians will deliver what you want. It's a very poll-driven situation. So if they see the polls that the whistleblower should be protected, if they see the polls that the president's misconduct is dangerous to American national security, Congress will respond accordingly. I think you're seeing that shift already, where people will finally take the plunge and do the right thing, because that feels better in the eyes of your children than doing something for strict self-interest. You know, it's what kind of legacy you want to leave that comes to mind at moments like these.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Alison Stanger. She's the author of Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. And as you may realize, it wasn't necessarily something she expected, but it is incredibly relevant right now. And the history, just the history alone of whistleblowing is fascinating. So thank you so much, Alison, and good luck to you. Are you still going to be touring around?
Yes, I'm moving around a bit. But it's enjoyable, and I enjoyed being on your show, Carol. Thanks for having me.
Okay, thank you.